or leave me. Either one you wanna do. Lord, you love me or leave me. Either one you wanna do. Because strange things is happening.
Oh, yeah. Strange things is happening. That's Percy Mayfield out of Minden, Louisiana, the poet laureate of the blues with his 1950 hit, Strange Things Happening. Mayfield also was a songwriter and pianist, and you may not know it, but he wrote the great hit, Hit the Road, Jack, and Please Send Me Someone to Love. He died in 1984 at the age of 64. This is Lead Stories. I'm Utrece Lead. And today, we are taking a look at media, my favorite topic, because we don't really subject media too often to very close scrutiny. We'll start with last night's Q&A. The third round of the Republican Q&A, which they continue to call a debate. And then we move on to former Prime Minister Tony Blair. But what ties these two things together is media and the role of media. A clear winner, it was a clear winner last night in the third two-tiered Q&A session, erroneously called a debate, among Republican presidential candidates last night, and the winner was actually not a person, but a point. And the point was about the role of the media, in this case, liberal media, two of the panelists claimed, in shaping coverage and in influencing public opinion. The two panelists who brought the same subject to the fore were Texas Senator Ted Cruz and from Florida Senator Marco Rubio. They both skewered CNBC's panel of questioners on the issue, though from a predictable point of view, I would say, that the mainstream media has been functioning almost like a public relations arm of the Democratic Party, and further, favoring Hillary Clinton. Now, as much as I hate to agree with them, I do. We've talked about this on the program. But I also contend that they did not actually go far enough to finish the thought. So let's hear what both senators have to say. We'll hear first from Ted Cruz as he attacks the CNBC moderators last night. And then right after that, we'll hear Marco Rubio coming in for the clinch.
Senator Cruz, congressional Republicans, Democrats, and the White House are about to strike a compromise that would raise the debt limit, prevent a government shutdown, and calm financial markets that fear of another Washington-created crisis is on the way. Does your opposition to it show that you're not the kind of problem solver American voters want?
You know, let me say something at the outset. The questions that have been asked so far in this debate illustrate why the American people don't trust the media. This is not a cage match. And you look at the questions, Donald Trump, are you a comic book villain? Ben Carson, can you do math? John Kasich, will you insult two people over here? Marco Rubio, why don't you resign? Jeb Bush, why have your numbers fallen? How about talking about the substantive issues people care about?
Does this count? Do we get credit for this one?
And Carl, I'm not finished yet. The contrast with the Democratic debate, where every fawning question from the media was, which of you is more handsome and wise?
So this is the question about the debt limit, which you have 30 seconds left to answer, should you choose to do so.
Let me be clear. The men and women on this stage have more ideas, more experience, more common sense than every participant in the Democratic debate. That debate reflected a debate between the Bolsheviks and the Mensheviks. And nobody watching at home believes that any of the moderators has any intention of voting in a Republican primary. The questions that are being asked shouldn't be trying to get people to tear into each other. It should be, what are your substantive solutions to people who are hurt?
I just want the record to reflect. I asked you about the debt limit, and I got no answer.
Okay, all right. You want me to answer that question? I'm happy to answer the question. I'm happy to answer the question, but let me tell you how the question is. Let me tell you how that
question is.
Let me tell you how that
question is. Senator Paul, I've got a question for you on the same subject.
So you don't actually want to hear the answer, John?
Senator Paul?
You don't want to hear the answer. You just want to listen to the insult.
You used your time on something else.
Not
my apologies. I'm sorry.
Everybody's really doing some bad facts.
Since I've been mentioned, can I respond?
Yes, you may.
You know, the Democrats have the ultimate super PAC. It's called the mainstream media. Whoever's seen the day. And I'll tell you why. Last week, Hillary Clinton went before a committee. She admitted she had sent emails to her family saying, hey, this attack in Benghazi was caused by al-Qaeda-like elements. She spent over a week telling the families of those victims and the American people that it was because of a video. And yet the mainstream media is going around saying it was the greatest week in Hillary Clinton's campaign. It was the week she got exposed as a liar. It was the week that she got exposed as a liar. But she has her super PAC helping her out, the American mainstream media.
Woo! Sparks are flying there. And I got to tell you, I agree. They were right on the head of the nail with this one. However, they also backed off and backed away from completing the thought. And what is this completing the thought? What does that have to do with? It has to do with the fact that this election, perhaps more so than any other, but this election marks a definitive turn. We've talked about it here in the tone of the coverage of presidential politics, but also in the role of the media. I talked about the fact that the media had hijacked this process with the consent of the Democratic Party and the Republican Party, taking this whole process out of the hands of the League of Women Voters, who traditionally had held these debates. But it was just too frumpy. These women, the League of Women Voters, only wanted to get people to the microphone so that the nation could hear what they had to say. They conducted debates. But that's not sexy. And there is so much money to be made. So they took this out of the hands of the League of Women Voters, and they made their own rules. The media did it, and the politicians went along with it, the Democratic Party and the Republican Party. And that's one of the reasons that neither Ted Cruz nor Marco Rubio could finish the thought. Because their own parties are guilty in this process of corrupting the process. So they can't have it both ways. But they are absolutely correct about the role of media being a kind of handmaiden to the Democrats, particularly Hillary Clinton, and refusing to subject her campaign and other campaigns as well to very close scrutiny. They're very, very, generally speaking, they're very one-sided in the way they have been covering this presidential campaign. Well, the chairman of the Republican National Committee, Rince Priebus, has said to CNBC, which historically has occupied dead last in the so-called ratings in cable news, expressing his extreme disappointment with the way CNBC handled the debate last night. He said it was just atrocious, and that the questions being asked of the candidates and the way, the conduct, the tone, the just the general demeanor of the questioners suggested that this was not designed to be an impartial or neutral kind of thing. This was just as Ted Cruz said, the media have been, and we discussed this, the media have been probing and poking, and they're loving it. This is how they created Donald Trump. The more outrageous and bombastic and racist he became, the better it was. They loved it. And why? Well, here's an answer. We gave the answer in a series of discussions around this. But I was intrigued by an article written by Stephen Battaglio of the Los Angeles Times. And I want to read it, share it with you. The headline is, Why CNBC is Counting on the Next Republican Debate to Raise Its Profile and Revenue. The article states, CNBC is getting its turn Wednesday on the presidential debate carousel and the potential for record ratings. The gathering of the Republican candidates for the 2016 presidential nomination at the Coors Event Center at the University of Colorado in Boulder is not expected to hit the Nielsen levels attained by previous showdowns seen on Fox News with 24 million on August the 6th and CNN with 22.9 million on September the 16th. But it's a shoo-in to score an all-time ratings high for NBC Universal's Business News cable network. Okay. The competition hears that CNBC is guaranteeing advertisers around 15 million viewers, which is in the range of what CNN pulled for its Democratic primary debate October the 14th. That would be a feat because CNBC focuses on business and finance and does not draw the casual news viewer that tunes into CNN or Fox News Channel. Many daytime viewers watch CNBC in their offices without the sound turned up, and NBC Universal no longer uses Nielsen to measure the ratings during its business coverage hours. The debate also airs directly against Game 2 of the World Series, which will provide significant competition for the older male viewers who make up a heavy component of the news audience. CNBC should benefit from the way viewers have gravitated to the debates, powered on the GOP side by the celebrity star power and unpredictability of Donald Trump in an unprecedented way. But as Trump's poll numbers have appeared to plateau, Wednesday's event may be the last where just his presence makes the debate a major attraction. Quote, we're at a time where you're going to see a fair amount of movement, unquote, said Nikhil Diogun, CNBC Business News Senior Vice President and Editor-in-Chief. Quote, you are at this point in the election cycle where voters are paying attention to the substance of the responses as well, unquote. The debate rating will undoubtedly top CNBC's previous ratings for a non-Olympic event set November the 9th, 2011, when 3.3 million tuned in for a Republican primary debate. As part of NBC's 2002 Winter Olympics coverage, CNBC hit 3.9 million viewers for an hour of coverage it carried. CNBC is taking advantage of the expected ratings boon. Its sales department was selling ad packages for around $200,000 for the two-hour debate and the coverage afterward, a multiple of their usual rates. CNBC could command a premium for the ad time, as research shows that the median income of its viewers, more than $70,000, is among the highest in television. CNBC anchor Carl Quintanilla, who will be querying the candidates alongside Squawk Box co-host Becky Quick and correspondent John Harwood, said he's aware that it's a major opportunity for a new audience to sample the channel's journalism. Quote, "We're going to get a lot of viewers who have never watched before," he said. "Hopefully, whatever people see, it will be all about the brand, NBC, and our commitment to do big events right." What did I tell you? Did I not tell you that the campaign is one of the biggest revenue events for these media outlets who are now hosting these so-called debates? Besides the Olympics, this is where they make their big money. We have the prediction by industry experts that campaign advertising would come around at least $5 billion this year, and they all want a piece of it. So here is even one of the moderators quoting the fact that, you know, this is about the brand. When did you hear this kind of talk? It is not about encouraging, you know, a civics and a knowledge of the political world and what's going on in their country and educating the public and the voter. It has nothing to do with it. It's still pay to play. And everybody is in it. Everybody's in it. You get the coverage that you can buy. So yes, while Ted Cruz is mad, and while Marco Rubio is mad, there is a long history of their party along with the other guys, the guys on the other side. Both parties corrupting the process. And now we have open participation by the media, which is also now trying to fool the public into thinking what you're getting is objective coverage of presidential politics. You've got to be kidding me. You see? Now, this reporter is reporting, I want to remind you, this report I just read from the Los Angeles Times is Stephen Battaglia, is supposed to be talking politics, don't you think? This report should be about what's going on, what's the tone of coverage, and so forth. All he's talking about with respect to these debates is the money that is going to be made, the ratings that are necessary in order for CNBC to pull in the kind of revenue that they're predicting. And we have at least one of the panelists agreeing that this is about promoting the NBC brand, not for just the quality of journalism that it delivers, but more importantly, its ability to carry off big events. This is just like we talked about CNN when it hosted that Q&A session with the Democrats. How elaborate the set and all these things had nothing to do with what Ted Cruz says. Let's talk about the substantive issues. Substantive issues, my foot, they're not interested in substantive issues. Because when the time comes for them to sit across the table with the campaign people who have their hands on the purse strings of those $5 billion in advertising, CNBC, which is starving, okay, it's dead last in the radio. It has been for a long time. They all are suffering. But they have had to, in their view, put together a sales pitch to the people they think have the most money to spend in political advertising. And that is what Ted Cruz is referring to as being, you know, or Marco Rubio talking about the media functioning almost like Hillary Rodham Clinton's a super PAC. Why? Because she has the most money. And if you placate her with free coverage and sympathetic coverage and you protect her the way they have been, and you ignore the reality, as what she said, is she was proven to be a liar. Where did that show up? You're not going to get that coverage. That's out the window. You cannot insult Hillary Clinton and then sit across the table and demand a huge chunk of the billions that she is going to be raising to buy the presidency. You're not going to get it. So this is what I mean by the fact that Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio, dead on with this point about the role of media, or the prostitutes, as Paul Craig Roberts refers to them, because they long ago abandoned this business about serious journalistic coverage. It's as if nobody is in the editorial room who is capable of determining what is a news story and covering it as such. What is ruling coverage? Is a consideration of the big bucks. And in order to get the big bucks, you have to have eyeballs looking at your programs. CNBC can't prove that it has the kind of eyeballs looking at its programs as Fox News does. So it has to try harder. But to say that this is just, you know, a wild accusation is to ignore the reality. This is real. This is how politics is being run now. Of course, we always had elements of this in previous campaigns. But it seems to me, and I've talked about it here, it seems to me that this particular election cycle is just open. I mean, they're not even caring to be delicate about it anymore. It's in your face. Look, it's about money. We're going to get what we need to get where we want to go. We have ambitions, and we know that the whole thing is about you can get what you want, including the presidency, and perhaps especially the presidency, if you have the money to do it, and the lion's share of that money is going to media organizations that could help people, could help in the campaigns, the individual campaigns, plans to sway people. And that is why they're all bundled together in this incestuous relationship that has at its base the corruption, utter and complete corruption of the process. And everybody's acting as if their hands are clean. The media people are saying, well, we're doing our job and we're bringing to the attention of the American voter what they need to know, and we are seasoned journalists, and you know that that's not true. The candidates themselves are standing there saying, well, we are before you and we're giving you the information that we hope you will use to support our candidacies, when they all know it's about money. If you have, look, that explains Donald Trump. What else explains Donald Trump? That he is a central figure in the presidential campaign. What explains any of them being actually potential candidates for the White House? What explains it other than money? It's all money, and they're all tied into it. So kudos for Ted Cruz. And kudos to Marco Rubio for at least having the courage to say it and to say it bluntly, because they're correct. But they also dodged the question. What is their role and their party's role in this mess, in this corruption of the process that has totally hijacked a simple premise of informing the electorate about the issues of the day, providing a platform in which people can come before the voters and explain their views and so forth, encouraging this idea of civics and this idea of voter education, and encouraging voter participation based on the sharing of information. These are really high ideals. The media, forget it. They're done. There is no credibility that you can say that any of the major media organizations have in terms of providing consistently objective coverage. Forget it. It doesn't exist anywhere. But I still say, even though I give Marco Rubio and Ted Cruz, and you know it hurts me to do it, it hurts me to admit that they are absolutely 100% right, but I say also that they could not and would not complete the thought for the reasons I just explained. We'll take this break and come back and talk about another farce that occurred before our very eyes and ears right after this. And misery. Yes, indeedy. Strange things is happening, indeed. You're listening to PRN.FM, and you're listening to Lead Stories on PRN.FM. CNN is all but gloating over Fareed Zakaria's interview with former Prime Minister Tony Blair. Interviewed as part of a special report Zakaria did on Iraq, Blair supposedly apologized for his and Britain's role as partners in the 2003 U.S.-led invasion of Iraq that toppled Saddam Hussein, who, as you know, eventually was assassinated, taken out, as they say, in the military world. It wreaked havoc in the country, and it just so happened it spawned the rise of ISIS. Blair's blame-shifting act of contrition was shameful enough, but Zakaria's and CNN's editorial assist with deft political scut work was even more so. Here's a portion of that interview.
Huge opposition within Britain to your decision to participate and support the invasion of Iraq. What kept you so firm in your conviction that it was the right decision?
I had a very clear view after 9/11 that we should be with America in confronting the threat of terrorism. The issue of terrorists getting hold of WMD was, for me, the major next dimension of this entire struggle. And I felt it important that the US didn't face this alone, that we were with them.
And of course, for that, you were occasionally derided as Bush's poodle. How did that make you feel?
Look, in politics, particularly when you're dealing with these types of decisions, you get used to a certain amount of abuse. So it didn't make a great deal of difference to me if people criticized me. What was important was that all the way through, however, we were obviously heavily involved with the development of policy. And we were also building the alliance with the US that allowed us to confront what we thought then, and I think there's a case for staying still now, is the biggest danger of this type of terrorism, which is that you get a coming together of people who are prepared to cause mass deaths with those people who are prepared to use weapons of mass destruction, whether a nuclear, chemical, or biological.
Given, however, that Saddam Hussein did not proved to have weapons of mass destruction, was the decision to enter Iraq and topple his regime a mistake?
You know, whenever I'm asked this, I can say that I apologize for the fact that the intelligence we'd received was wrong, because even though he had used chemical weapons extensively against his own people, against others, the program in the form that we thought it was, did not exist in the way that we thought. So I can apologize for that. I can also apologize, by the way, for some of the mistakes in planning, and certainly our mistake in our understanding of what would happen once you removed the regime. But I find it hard to apologize for removing Saddam. I think even from today in 2015, it is better that he's not there than that he is there.
When people look at the rise of ISIS, many people point to the invasion of Iraq as the principal cause. What do you say to them?
I think there are elements of truth in that, but I think we've again got to be extremely careful, otherwise we'll misunderstand what's going on in Iraq and in Syria today. Of course, you can't say that those of us who removed Saddam in 2003 bear no responsibility for the situation in 2015, but it's important also to realize, one, that the Arab Spring, which began in 2011, would also have had its impact on Iraq today, and two, ISIS actually came to prominence from a base in Syria and not in Iraq. And that leads me to the broader point, which I think is so essential when we're looking at policy today, which is we have tried intervention and putting down troops in Iraq. We've tried intervention without putting in troops in Libya. And we've tried no intervention at all but demanding regime change in Syria. Right? It's not clear to me that even if our policy did not work, subsequent policies have worked better.
You went from being really the most successful British politician of your generation, perhaps of a lot a larger time period than that, to being called a war criminal. How has that made you feel?
Look, I think one of the responsibilities you get when you get a big position of power is, in the end, in these big decisions, you've got to do what you think is right. Now, whether it's right or not, that's for everyone can have their judgment about that. But when I think of my crime, if you like, which is removing Saddam Hussein, and then I think of what frankly has happened in the world as we've watched Syria unfold in these last years, with hundreds of thousands of people dying, often innocent civilians, barrel bombed, starved, subject to the most horrific weapons, including chemical weapons. And we have stood back, and we in the West, and again, we bear responsibility for this, in Europe most of all, we've done nothing. I don't know. I think that's a judgment of history I'm prepared to have. But we'll see. Look, this was the most difficult decision I ever took in politics. And I was aware at the time I was taking it that it was going to be politically extremely difficult. I do point out, by the way, because I always do this to people, I did actually win an election after Iraq. But I agree, it's been a huge political problem. But I am the least significant aspect of this. It's what's happening today that should really concern us.
Tony Blair, pleasure to have you on.
Thank you, Freddie.
He's really not kidding, Farida Zakaria. It is a pleasure to have you on. Now, here's the work. The work is 888-874-4888. What did you just hear? What did you just hear? Now, this was a special report. They had a lot of time to prepare for it. CNN has been touting it. Of course, that's part of the marketing, to say this is destined to be a prize-winning special report. So they're angling for that already. But what did we hear? What was the role of the media, Zakaria? And what did you hear from Tony Blair? This is mind-boggling. Mind-boggling. I want to know how you deconstruct what we just heard. 888-874-4888. What was said, what was not said, and what was the job, in your view, of the reporter in this interview? What was Zakaria's job? Did he do it? And why do you think, or if you think he did it, why do you think he did it? And if you think he didn't do it, why do you think he did not do his job as a journalist? This is the great CNN, international organization, news organization that has and enjoys great acclaim all over the world for its authoritative reporting, interviewing the former prime minister, who played the major role at the time in representing both his personal and political interests, as well as the country's interests, in partnering with the United States in the invasion of Iraq and all of these consequences that followed. What did you hear? That's the task. You know, we don't play around here. We give you work to do, and it involves you deconstructing for us what it is they tell you the reality is. On one hand, we had, they called it a bombshell interview. It's a bombshell interview, and they're touting it as a bombshell interview in order to suggest, of course, CNN had exclusive access to Tony Blair. And Zakaria, of course, personally having this access, he's interviewing a former head of state. This is big deals. This big deal type journalism. But what happened here? What happened here? What did you hear? What is the language? What words came to mind when you were listening? What jarred your attention? From Washington, D.C., what did you hear, Free?
I heard, I want to thank you for this opportunity as well. I heard the host asking about how Tony Blair felt. How do you feel being called by some a war criminal? He didn't ask him about whether war crimes had been executed, about the millions of lost lives of the Iraqis. He's asked him a softball question about his emotional state and maybe how it affected him personally. And what I heard was a whitewashing of genocide.
Okay. What should he have asked?
He should have
How could he have come? This is now Zakaria. How could Zakaria have used that particular focus to elicit a great deal more from Tony Blair?
Well, when Tony Blair spun the conversation back to what Saddam allegedly did to his own people, the host Zakaria could have given the evidence right there out of the British School of Medicine, the Lancet report about the civilians that were killed during the Iraq War. He could have talked about the white phosphorus and depleted uranium, which were used by the Allied forces during the Iraq War to counter this concept that the Iraqis were deserving, or Saddam Hussein. They never mentioned the people. They always act like we only took out one person. They don't mention the destruction of an entire country and way of life. They want to minimalize it to an individual. But Zakaria could have turned it back around to say that that the Iraqis were not unique in being, you know, war criminals or using these type of weapons, when it was known that the United States and the Allies did very similar, if not worse, things, particularly with depleted uranium, which has a half-life way beyond our lifetime on this planet.
Well, I give you great kudos for the fact that you honed in on a very, very important thing, and that is the personalization of the question. How do you feel? Who cares how he feels?
Exactly.
What does the record show that he ought to feel? Do you see or did you hear Zakaria utilize his own personal knowledge of a situation or CNN's cumulative knowledge of the particulars of the invasion of Iraq to use as a basis for his questions? Did you hear him bring that in at all?
I've heard better interviews from Barbara Walters doing some of those celebrity interviews. He didn't bring in a basis for
anything. What's your favorite color, Mr. Prime Minister?
If you were a tree, which would you be?
Now, one big question. This is a very important thing that you pointed out, because this is how it looks, and it sounds like a very important interview being conducted. I mean, he has unfettered access to the former head of state. And this person, one assume, has unique information to offer if questioned properly, to elicit all these unanswered questions that have been brewing all these years since 2003 and perhaps even before that. And then, where he should have connected with Blair, he decided that he was going to ask him how he personally feels. And did you hear an apology?
No. It was very qualified, very nuanced. He apologized for having bad intel, not what they did with the intel. He made no apology to the people of Iraq who continue to suffer. There was no apology there. And I wanted to add this, Nutrice. New evidence was just released recently, like in the last week or so, probably before the interview that this guy Zakaria did, that Bush and Blair had planned the war way in a year in advance, you know, prior through this information that came out. And none of that was used. It was like, I think very much that we're in this Orwellian kind of thing where people are just kind of creating a reality through the media that has nothing to do with any facts or any of that. And if you strictly are on a diet of mainstream media, you're going to be totally mind controlled because they're not even dealing with the factual information that's available.
Yet CNN is touting this interview, this bombshell interview, because it reveals, information not known before. And here we have what they're saying is his apology, Blair's apology, except that Blair says, and this is his apology, "I apologize for the fact that the intelligence we received was wrong." How the heck is that? How is that an apology, I ask you? But you were fantastic in bringing these points to the fore today. I thank you for contributing today, Pree, from Washington, D.C.
Thank you. Love your show.
Thank you. Love you for contributing. From Connecticut, Tom, what did you hear?
Hello, Yatrice.
Hello.
When he was discussing the atrocities of Saddam on his own people, the interviewer could have brought up perhaps the Madeleine Albright interview where she was pressed on 60 Minutes about the, I recall the exact number, but I believe it was at least 500,000, if not more, that had been killed up to that point.
Most of them children, and she said,
correct.
No, children. No, basically, this is what happens.
No, this is a price we are willing to pay.
Mm-hmm.
Referencing that may have given the former prime minister pause to reflect on who is committing what atrocities. A point that could have been made.
Did you hear the journalist, Fareed Zakaria, in any way weave into his discussions, into his questions, any of the cumulative knowledge he ought to have had about the subject, either because he personally covered this topic or that he drew on CNN's body of information about this topic, as in a way of saying, this is what we know, rather than ask these open-ended questions that he could have drawn himself in and CNN in, since CNN is an international authority on Iraq.
I don't believe that was his place to do that. I think he was just there to offer this as some kind of, just media fluff that, oh, here's a mea culpa from the former prime minister, which was the case. He just kind of muddled through and made no, apologies at all, really, except for, the bad intelligence, really ridiculous. No one has ever taken to task for these things dramatically, in a dramatic fashion, to really put them on the spot.
Well, this interview is being aired in anticipation of the release of a major investigation in Britain on the dealings of Blair and his government with respect to the Iraq war, you see? So in advance of that, you have a nice soft interview that purportedly is about an apology that Blair is making to an international news medium, CNN. And it looks like he's apologizing. Well, it looks like he's taking responsibility. And they have a very credible news person there, basically chaperoning the whole process. But it is very interestingly timed in advance of the release of this report, which, by the way, has taken 6 years so far. Well. And Blair himself was one of the people obstructing its release for all these many years. But it's a very interesting thing. But I think you're right on with this as well. Thank you so much for calling in
today.
Very
good. Always a pleasure talking with you. Bye.
Thank you so much. Same here. Ali from New York, what did you hear?
What I heard was that Mr. Blair was talking about WMD. But I wish that Zachariah would have asked him, if he was so worried about WMD, how come he was not worried when the United States provided Saddam Hussein with gas to gas the people of Kurdistan, the Kurds? So I wanted to know the difference. How come he didn't ask him that question? Because, you see, it's like you were talking before. These people, they know when they bring these people into this station, into the TV station, or they interview them, they already know what they're going to ask them. And of course, they're never going to ask them the right question. Because if he was so worried about WMD and joining with the United States, Mr. Blair, joining with United States, how come he wasn't worried when we saw the former Secretary of Defense, Rumsfeld, talking to Saddam Hussein, and that was when that gas was given so they could use it against the Kurds? And if you notice about him, every time that he was talking, for the most part, things that they were lied, and he didn't know how to give it a good explanation. He was posing, like he was trying to figure it out what to say, the right thing to say.
Well, this goes back to the point that Free from Washington, D.C. made about this seemed to be the role, and Tom commented about that. It seemed to be Zakaria's role to soften the blow and to soften Blair in the eyes of the public. And he is hated in Britain. But it seemed as if that was a major task of this interview, to provide the environment in which this so-called apology is made, to soften him up and to soften the blow and to soften the opposition to him, should it arise after the release of this report, to provide him the opportunity to be ahead of this report, and at the same time to do nothing whatsoever to enlighten the public about the inner workings of Blair's administration with respect to Iraq and his involvement with the United States in the invasion and the consequences coming out of that. Thank you so much, Ali. Thank you, Tom. Thank you, Free. Great, great questions and insights, and I always thank you so much for maintaining such a very high standard in bringing to the fore points you would like us to consider when we talk about these things. And always remember that you have to keep your brain on because there's a lot that's going on here that is now being deliberately orchestrated to stultify us, to make us ignorant, to make us patsies, to make us not think. And the media should be looked with, especially mainstream media, should be looked with great suspicion because they're not doing their jobs. They are part now of the information, disinformation complex. This is what they're doing. They are actively involved in creating alternate realities that would get us distracted from what it is we need to know. So until they prove themselves worthy of our trust, our automatic attitude should be, we don't trust what you're saying. I end with the ironic thing that today I'm actually agreeing with Ted Cruz and with Marco Rubio. Who would have thunked it? Strange things, as the song says, strange things is happening. Keep it right here on PRN.FM. Coming up next is Expanding Mind with Eric Davis. You can reach me at leadstories@gmail.com. I hope this program did something to enlighten your day. A pleasure and a great privilege, as always, to be in your company. And we meet tomorrow for Free Your Mind Friday. Get your brains in gear. Bye-bye.
Will I find me crying too? Midnight find me crying, daylight find me crying too.